That's the sound of Green Hearts, the Vegan Vibe. We have another 0.5 episode for you. This time it's going to be a little bit longer, and it's different in the sense that Alex and I are both interviewing this time.
This week we have a special guest. Dino, say hi to our listeners.
Hi, listeners. I'm all kinds of special.
He is all kinds of special. Dino is the author of The Alternative Vegan, and we're going to ask you for a short biography later, but maybe you could just give just a brief introduction of why they care who you are.
Because I do vegan food without OmniSubs.
Beautiful. We're actually going to talk about that later as well. But first, I'm going to start off by asking you, what kind of foods do you like to make when you're in a rush?
When I'm in a rush, I tend to depend on convenience foods like tinned beans, frozen veg, that kind of thing. And, you know, I skip like the long, drawn-out stuff like, you know, chopping onions, mincing garlic, you know, getting fresh herbs, all that other stuff. I'm just like, throw a couple of spices in there, throw some oil in, you know, throw in the rest of it, call it an effing night, and move on.
So you wouldn't just eat garbanzo beans right out of the can like some people that I've heard?
If I was feeling that lazy that I didn't even have time to cook it, I would at least go to the effort of making hummus.
Cool.
At the very bare minimum. I mean, I'm talking about, like, hummus takes less than 5 minutes, and that's, you know, if I'm more pressed for time than that, I'll eat a piece of fruit.
Yeah, perfect. Fruit's like the perfect food.
Yeah.
Honestly, when it gets to the point where it's like, if you're telling me that you're feeling that lazy that you can't even be fussed to, you know, cook the beans up real quick, go ahead and eat some raw vegetables or some raw fruit, because there is absolutely nothing faster or easier or more healthy than that.
Yeah.
So Alex tells me that you're pretty much a natural vegan, and so, like, no, no mock meat kind of things.
Well, I don't know how natural the cigarette smoking is, but, or the artificial sweetener once in a while. No, I'm kidding. I do smoke cigarettes. I do drink once in a while. But with regards to food, I tend to be very stripped down, very basic, very sort of produce and that kind of thing driven, where if I do use, let's say, beans or something like that, it's maybe once or twice a day or something like that, rather than where beans are the center of the meal, you know, because I've had the same problem happening with, my husband, for one, is that he was raised in the United States where protein is the center of your meal. And I was raised in South India where rice is the center of your meal and everything else that goes with the rice is your sides, I guess. So for us, you know, if we're having beans, you're talking about like maybe a half a cup, maybe a cup or so. For him, having beans is like having soup, you know what I mean? And he'll have just like an entire bowl of beans with barely any rice at all. And it's been a little bit of a challenge. So what I end up doing is that I end up diluting it. And for me, you know, like beans are considered expensive cooking, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So I guess that culture clash is sort of the biggest thing that I've noticed in terms of expense. But with regards to making food happen, food is not hard to make happen. It's vegetables, it's beans, it's occasionally pasta if I'm really in the mood for it. And granted, I'm always in the mood for pasta, but that's not the point. It's just that it's really expensive.
Yeah.
In comparison to rice, where even the most expensive rice can cost me about 50 cents a pound if I'm spending super duper high amounts of money for the rice, it'll be maybe like $1, maybe $2 a pound, but that's about your upper limit. I've seen pasta, if the cheap stuff going for about 50 cents a pound, and then the more expensive stuff going for like $8-$9 a pound.
And it sounds like you need to save that, because from what I hear, Dino, Steve eats a lot.
He does. Steve is a very big eater, and I'm not a huge eater, I'm just a frequent eater, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's how I am too.
Yeah.
I tend to have meals, my idea of a meal is like about a cup, maybe a half a cup or so of food at a time, but I have about 12 of them in a day.
Wow.
Yeah.
So I get my calories in, it's not that I don't, it's just that I tend to graze rather than, you know, sit down for like a full meal.
I ate over at Alex's the other day, and they gave me, like, they cooked enough soup for how many people?
I guess about 10 people.
Yeah, and they gave me, like, this huge bowl of soup, and I'm like you, I'm more of a grazer, so I only have, like, a small tank, but it empties fast kind of thing.
Yes.
So I was, like, I was done after half the bowl, and everyone was just kind of looking at me like, really?
Right.
I thought that was pretty funny.
Well, let me tell you, this tank empties out rather quickly, especially with how much water I drink, so I understand.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, this whole natural eating thing kind of leads into your cookbook. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
I don't know that I would even call it natural so much as basic, you know? It's natural sort of implies that I'm saying that you need to go back to this crunchy, hippie
Right. Yeah. I call it natural.
Shall we say? About, you know, everything has to be grown from the earth, and you have to get everything fresh, and you have to do everything super duper, you know, stripped down. That I'm not saying that you should go quite that far, nor am I saying that you should go to the opposite direction and get everything processed and frozen and unrecognizable in its original form anymore. All I'm saying is the food should be simple in the sense that you can recognize most of what's in there. And I'm not saying that the source needs to be the same. For example, I would sooner you ate the minced garlic in the little jar and use that for your cooking than use no garlic at all. Yeah. I would sooner that you ate frozen vegetables than no vegetables at all. I would sooner that you ate tinned beans than the absolute garbage that you get at fast food restaurants or even regular restaurants.
Yeah. Yeah, just to clarify for listeners, when I say natural, I mean like non-fake meats and stuff. Sure. So focusing more on produce.
Oh, no, absolutely. And then we're in complete agreement. But for me, when I hear natural, I hear sort of this commitment to organic and to fresh grown and to locally grown and this and that. And it's for me, I don't really have the time or the patience for all of that, seeing as how I have a job. I'm at work from something to the tune of, 12-ish until about 7 at night. And my husband works at all odd hours because he does freelancing. Cool. So between the two of us, we do eat very sort of basic food, but none of it is what I would call natural. A lot of it comes from far away just because it's cheap. You're talking about, you know, the potatoes came from Idaho, the onions came from, I don't know, Georgia, and the oranges came from Florida, but they're cheap and they're good and they'll do the job right now. And that's all I'm really worried about. And for my more, let's say, green loving heart, shall we say, that side of me that does really enjoy fresh, locally grown, high quality produce. That's why I have my community support and agriculture share every week, which goes on a sliding scale. And so since we don't make very much money, ours cost, I think, about $15 a week.
That's a good deal.
That's really cool.
And that's for the season, $15 a week in terms of produce made it so that I can take my grocery bill down from where it used to be about $20 a week. Now it's about $60 a month.
Cool.
Yeah, like it's the funny thing is, even though I'm paying a little bit more in terms of that fresh, local, organic produce, I'm paying less in my overall grocery bill, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. The thing I noticed looking through your cookbook is that for someone with allergies who can't eat any kind of those alternative kind of things, it's perfect. All your recipes are pretty simple and pretty basic, like you say.
And very accessible in the sense that you're allowed to substitute if you don't have something.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
And in your case, Brendan, I would assume that it's excellent because you're allowed to substitute in case you can't have something.
Right. Yeah, definitely.
Which is the kind of thing which I wanted to do because I've traveled all over the world and there are places where you'll go where they've never heard of a soybean. They don't know what, you know, tempeh is. They've couldn't care less what seitan is, and they're not about to waste all that much starch in making it in the first place.
Yeah.
So, because if you really think about it, the process of making seitan is you have to, you know, if you're making it from scratch, that is, you get that wheat flour, and then you massage it, you know, with water, and then you massage it under running water until all the starch goes away. Now, what happens to that starch? It goes down your sink.
Exactly.
And now you're left with the gluten, which is, I would say, a small fraction of what you originally started out with. And as it is with the shortages of grain across the planet, the cost of rice and wheat and legumes and other things like that have been shooting up through the roof to the point where I have noticed a marked increase in my grocery bill. If it had been the same prices that I was paying for groceries, let's say the year that I moved into our apartment, my grocery bill would have gone from $20 a week down to, you know, $20 every 3 weeks or so.
Mm-hmm. That's because amazing.
Because that's CSA.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm saying is like the cost of grain has shot up through the roof. And so to tell somebody, oh, by the by, here's a bunch of wheat flour that you just spent something to the tune of 50 cents a pound on. And now we're going to throw away half of it down the drain.
Yeah. Exactly.
They're going to look at you like you have three heads.
Yeah.
And if you're from my neck of the woods, they're going to punch you in the face and say, give me that wheat flour and get the heck out of my way so that I can actually go make some, you know, flatbread for you, or I can make some regular bread for you, or I can put it into my food. It's this entire concept of waste is a very first world thing.
So yeah. Where did this idea come from? Like, Did it come from the Indian roots?
Watching my vegan friends talk about food and the kinds of things that they would do. There was this discussion going on about how they were using phyllo for something or another. And they were talking about how they melted earth balance and they spread it on there. And I'm like, why couldn't you just use oil?
Yeah.
You've melted the earth balance anyway. You're probably not going to taste it because you've drowned it in sugar.
Oh, look at that.
And it's not just sugar, it's rose water, so it gives that really nice flavor.
Yeah.
So you're really not going to notice too much of a difference between the oil and the earth balance. Just use the oil. Why do you have to go and spend, you know, all this money on this earth balance and then go and melt it and lose the entire purpose of having it in the first place, which is, you know, to have it as something that's spreadable on something?
Yeah, I like the fact, too, that in your cookbook it's simple and everything is accessible for people, say, in rural areas or in the north.
Yes.
Yeah, we can't access a lot of things. Well, Timmins is not too bad, but I lived in a really, really rural place, and I don't think if we had cookbooks that called for things like seitan, tofu, we would have been able to access that stuff, so we probably would have just, I don't know, starved to death.
And I'm not even just talking about the seitan and the tofu. I'm talking about, like, the more expensive ingredients that a lot of these cookbooks call for, especially in their baking recipes, like soy creamer. Like, are you kidding me?
I know.
Soy creamer? Seriously. Until I moved to New York City, I had never even heard of the stuff. I had no idea what they were talking about.
Yeah. Yeah.
That stuff is expensive.
Yeah, I've never actually even heard of that here.
There's recipes that are calling for soy milk powder and for soy creamer and for all kinds of other ingredients that if you're not living in a very large urban vegan-friendly area, because even if you're living in an urban area that's not vegan-friendly, they're not going to have this stuff.
Exactly.
And if you're living in an especially poor area, you're definitely not going to have access to this stuff, because then the nearest option for you is to go to the Whole Paycheck. That's never in a poor neighborhood.
Yeah, and it's always good to save money.
And it's always good to save money. And the thing is that what are you going to do if you're in the middle of, you know, Chennai somewhere, in the middle of South India somewhere, and your nearest market sells produce, and they sell all the produce you could possibly want to the tune of, you know, 40, 15 different varieties of spinach and 5, 6 different varieties of aubergines and like 5 or 6 different varieties of mangoes and 20 varieties of papaya and all this other produce all over the place. And your silly cookbook is asking for soy creamer, and you're like, I'm sitting on top of a produce gold mine.
Exactly.
And you're telling me to go find some soy creamer. Are you really serious?
Yeah. Looking through some of the more yucky cookbooks, I've noticed a lot, like, they have way too many ingredients, and you just don't have the time to even read through the ingredients, I find, and let alone find them in the grocery store.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I will admit to a great extent that I do call for some spices that are a little bit more obscure.
Yeah.
But as far as I've noticed, I have yet to have anybody write me and say they cannot find cumin.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Pretty basic.
Or that they cannot find sesame seeds or mustard seeds, or that they cannot find, you know, like those, or coriander seeds. Like, coriander seeds have become very well known. Either through the Indian spreading out or through the Middle Easterner spreading out or whoever spreading out. The point is that these spices that I'm asking for 99% of the time are fairly easy to locate. The one that I would even say that people had trouble with was turmeric.
Really?
Yeah, I know. I love how you both chorused at the same time. Really? And then the other one, which was completely optional, and I've said it thousands of times, was asafoetida. And I said, if you don't have it, don't use it. No big deal. So, like, if you can't find it, just leave it out. Curry leaves, if you can't find it, leave it out. No big deal. Yeah. But the thing is that the turmeric would be one of those where it does give that color and the flavor, and it is fairly important to have. And I think I've reported one person saying that they had issues finding it, but she, I think, was in the frozen north somewhere, where their nearest Asian-y store is, you know, the aisle at the supermarket where they have all the Asian products.
Sounds like us.
Yeah, we're pretty far north, and it's in our normal supermarkets.
Well, that's what I told her, is that she shouldn't be looking in the Asian section. She should just be looking in the spice section. And so she said she went to the store and she went back to the spice section and she found it there.
Yeah, that makes
sense.
That's
how prevalent these spices have become. And actually, she said at first when she went to the Asian aisle, she couldn't find turmeric, but she found curry powder, which had a lot of the same flavors.
Mm-hmm.
So she used all the same techniques that I've been having in the book, like with the popping of the whole spices and the sauteing of the aromatics, and then adding in, you know, the turmeric after you add in the aromatics, and then adding in the deglazing, and then adding in the vegetables, and blah, 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 blah. after all is said and done, you know, subbing out a teaspoon of curry powder for like, you know, a quarter teaspoon of turmeric, not going to be the end of the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It'll still taste pretty fantastic. And I think that's what she learned, was that maybe you don't have exactly what I'm asking you to go get. That doesn't mean you can't make it.
That's really what I like about your cookbook too, is it teaches you to be more fearless in the kitchen, not so tentative, I guess, when you're cooking.
Yeah, tentative and sort of like, you know how when you first start cooking, there's all these mistakes that you know you're going to make and you're kind of scared of making them?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, my sister's like that, I find. We'll be making something in a fry pan, she'll kind of just throw it in, and I'm just like, Shayla, for God's sake, don't do that, you're going to burn yourself. And it's just that kind of like, I don't want to screw up, so I'm just going to be...
And it's also a money thing. It's a, you know, I just spent all this money on these ingredients, and it's also a hunger thing. I'm starving now, and I need to eat something.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's me right now.
And if I mess it up, I'm not going to be able to have dinner on the table at any point in the near future.
Well, you just have a less tasty dinner. My secret is if I ever mess something up, then I just pour a cock sauce all over it. For those of you who don't know the brand name, it's just like a sweet chili sauce.
Sriracha.
Sure.
Yeah, that's what it's called. It's just a really wonderful Thai chili sauce. It goes on everything, and it's wonderful.
Yeah, cool. And it masks flavors really well if you screw something up.
Well, speaking of screwing up, let me tell you guys how I got started with not screwing things up. Was working with the microwave a lot. Was that when I first learned how to cook, my mother didn't really let me use the stove all that much. She would let me chop vegetables, mind you, and I'm this, you know, 7-year-old boy who holding a huge, you know, 7-8-inch chef's knife chopping away at vegetables. And she was fine with that. And she was fine with me doing it on my own. I didn't have to have adult supervision for that. She was like, go chop these vegetables. I've got to do stuff. I'll BRB. So she would go about her business, and you know, she never had problems with me making myself a salad when I was at home by myself. So I would get, you know, all these vegetables and put them together into a salad, into an elaborate salad, and eat that when I was hungry. But then sometimes when I wanted something a little bit more, she wouldn't really let me use the stove because she was nervous that I was going to hurt myself. Do we see the irony here?
Yeah.
I'm not the only one. Okay, good. So what she said is, I don't feel comfortable with you using the stove. And I said, well, what about the microwave? It's not like I'm turning on a fire or anything. And she was like, okay, yeah, that's fine. So again, do we see the irony yet? she was nervous about, you know, the stove being too high up off the ground for me. And then, you know, I knock something over and get hurt or something. But the microwave wasn't exactly on the floor. So anyway, and you know how those pots can get in the microwave. They can get some pretty hot pots in there.
Yeah.
So sure. What I learned to do initially was I would watch what my mother would do on top of the stove. And instead of doing that on the stove, what I would do is that I would do it in stages in the microwave. So if I wanted to make a tomato sauce, what I would do is that I would open up a tin of tomatoes and throw in some of that, spice blend or whatever. And I wouldn't add any oil because I didn't want the oil to splatter and make a mess. And then I would throw it in the microwave for a couple of minutes, nuke it for a couple of minutes. And then when it would come out, then I would add, you know, a couple of tablespoons of oil, mix it all the way through, and then nuke it for another minute or so. 3 minutes later, I've got a really good pasta sauce on my hands, which I can put on top of bread or, you know, take some pasta from the fridge, which she would have already boiled, and throw it on top of that, throw it back in the microwave for a couple of minutes, and I'm good to go.
And that solves the whole problem that people bring up all the time, that veganism or vegetarianism takes longer. I mean, it takes more chopping, but if you do stuff like this, there's lots of ways to make vegan and vegetarian cooking really fast.
And that's the same thing with the frozen vegetables that I was telling you about at the beginning of the show, was that if you really are saying that you're that pressed for time, go get some frozen vegetables. And here's the quickest way to thaw frozen vegetables. Put them into a strainer, run water over them until they're thawed. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
That is how fast it is. There is no reason to be putting it in the microwave and setting some defrost function and whatever else. You don't have to worry about all that nonsense. We're not cooking dead things. So all you have to do is, you know, quickly rinse it under cold water and then dump it into your microwave bowl, throw on some spice blend, throw in a bit of oil, toss it a couple of times through to mix it, dump it in your microwave for 2 minutes flat, you're good to go.
Beautiful.
You have cooked vegetables in 2 minutes. That is a record.
Unless you're using a pressure cooker.
It's faster than a pressure cooker because the pressure cooker has to come with pressure and all the rest of it. Like, With this, you're talking about throw it in, get it out, move on with your life. And this also works for raw vegetables, is that if you buy those broccoli florets that come in the store in the package, not the ones that are frozen, the fresh ones.
All right.
You use the same technique with the oil and the spices and the rest of it, and you nuke it for about 5 minutes covered, then about another 2 minutes uncovered, and you're set.
Cool.
Perfectly, perfectly steamed broccoli. You only need to add maybe like, let's say for a head of broccoli, you need to add maybe like a few tablespoons of water just to help it steam a little bit quicker.
Mm-hmm.
But the bottom line is you're not heating up a giant pot. You're not putting a huge steamer in there. And for gosh sakes, it has flavor.
And it has a lot of nutrients too. For our listeners, calcium is a big component of broccoli.
Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely. And this is what I'm saying, is that when I first started cooking and I was very, very nervous about messing things up in the kitchen, this is what I would do to sort of tied me over until I learned the technique of it, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As soon as I learned the techniques of flavoring and oiling and spicing and all the rest of it in the microwave, which only took like a couple of minutes at a time, so if I messed something up, I could always go back and have a baked potato, which by the by only takes 4 minutes in the microwave.
Yeah, I've done that before. That's helpful. And make sure you poke holes, because if you don't, the potato will explode.
It will make a mess and you will not be happy.
Well, it depends on how old you are.
Well, that too. If you're young, you'll be excited, but if you're the parent who has to clean up the mess, you will not be too happy.
Yeah.
But what I've found is that if I was really, really nervous about that whole microwave thing not ending well, you know, I could always fall back on a baked potato, and that took me 4 minutes flat, and I'm good to go.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
I think it's...
Go ahead, Brennan.
Sorry. As a future, like, educator, because I'm going into teaching in school, I think it's really important that we start educating kids on how to cook at an early age, like your mom let you do. And especially with things like the microwave, it's a perfect medium for doing that.
To get started. And, of course, she did teach me those safety things. Never put metal in there.
Definitely.
Don't ever put... thank God this is not an issue for vegans, but don't ever put a whole egg in there. You know, don't touch the food directly after it comes out. Don't stick your face in the thing when you're opening off the lid. You know, wear oven mitts when you take it out of the microwave. Like, all these things she had drilled into my head by that point.
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't going to, you know, damage myself irreparably. It was just a giant knife that would do that job.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
But I feel like in this book, what I've done is that I've gone through and I've made all the mistakes for you.
Yeah.
And I specifically tell you where I've made mistakes before and tell you, don't do that, do this, and you'll be okay.
Cool.
And I think that's what you're ready to do.
We're going to move on a little bit, if that's okay.
Great.
We have some questions about India.
Sure.
So one of the things that we were wondering is what any native language of India sounds like, because there are more than one, am I correct?
Yes, there's I think there's something to the tune of 25.
Wow.
Right. So, but that's mainly, and it's not 25 languages like you would say Italian, French, and Spanish. It's more like 25 languages like you would say Dutch, Tamil, and English, and then, you know, yeah. They're completely different language roots. They're completely different sounding. There's a couple that are vaguely related, let's say second cousins or something, but aside from that, they branched.
Are they mainly regional languages? Is that where they come from? Or
it's because India was never a nation to begin with.
Okay,
that makes sense.
Much like Italy, India used to be a bunch of little city-states, and they would all govern themselves with their own kings and their own queens and their own everything else. And so, naturally, they would develop their own languages. So those particular regions that were closer to the Silk Road in the trading routes, they developed their own languages that were somewhere, like in the north, in the very far north. There's a lot of Hindi spoken, which is sort of like a mangling version of Persian and Arabic and Sanskrit and Punjabi and Marathi and like a bunch of other languages that are just mishmashed into one, which is Hindi, because the speakers of Hindi would be going back and forth from the Persians and the Arabs and the Indians, and they would be, you know, they would be the mediators. To this day, if you learn Hindi in your school, you will have no idea what the speakers of Hindi in Delhi are doing. Because the Hindi that was spoken way back then is a reflection of the Hindi that was needed in those times. The Hindi that's spoken today now also has English thrown into it.
Really?
No, I'm serious. It's really bad. when there's certain words in Hindi that just didn't quite make across. For example, the proper way to say thank you in Hindi is dhanyabad, which means, you know, thank you. It means literally thank you. The bastardized way of saying it in Hindi, where everybody uses it, is shukriya, which is a bastardization of the Arabic shukra, which also means thank you in Arabic. And so they just did something to it and made it their own.
Yeah, that is really similar to Italy, except the difference being that different Italian dialects are more similar than what you describe as the different Indian languages.
Well, they're distinct languages, and that's the problem, is that on top of those languages, you also have the dialects that are specific to each caste of each language, and then you have those local dialects that are specific to each caste, to each locality.
Cool.
People didn't travel much, shall we say.
Could you speak a little bit of whatever native language you speak?
My most fluent one is Tamil, and I was basically saying Tamil is the one I'm most familiar with. I call my mother, and we talk in it all the time. And if you've noticed, I tend to throw English in there from here to there.
Oh, cool.
That's really cool.
Is there a word?
What happens in South India, too, is that because of the influence of TV and the rest of it, we start using English, and actually we start Tamilifying English words. And vice versa, we start Englishifying Tamil words. I think it's really interesting to watch how the language has grown from where it used to be and what it's become now, especially when you get Tamil spoken in a country where it's properly spoken, which is Sri Lanka. They speak the proper high flown, you know, real Tamil that was spoken, you know, thousands of years ago, and they've preserved it, and it's beautiful to listen to. And the Brahmins bastardized it with Sanskrit, and then the South Indians bastardized it with their, you know, local dialects. And so the stuff that we speak in South India, where I'm from, is unrecognizable to somebody from Sri Lanka who actually speaks the proper Tamil. So my version is a really messed up sounding one.
That sounds a lot like the Quebec French versus the
Is
French
it that
French.
Bad?
It's pretty slang, yeah.
Yeah, it is pretty slang. It's called La Joelle, and it's totally different than normal French.
Well, we tend to slur a lot, so what used to have a very, you know, crisp and clean pronunciation, now the words kind of run into each other, and we tend to break off the ends of words, and we tend to Sanskritize stuff and add sounds that were never in Tamil to begin with.
Actually, the language that my Nona speaks, she speaks a dialect, and that's what they do too. They cut off the end of the words. So, for example, if you were going to say Yupuma, instead of saying Yupuma, they'd say Yupum.
Yep. Yes.
That's pretty cool. Could you speak a little bit to the difference between North and South Indian cultures?
Sure, absolutely. In the South, we have a very tropical climate. You're talking hot, humid, rainy for, let's say, a good 2-3 months out of the year. Or when it's hot, you're talking about a good 100 degrees in the shade. That's Fahrenheit. And so the extremes are very different. And then in the North, you have the mountains and you have the winter and you have actual defined seasons. So what happens is that in the North, you have a temperature that's very conducive to wheat and cattle. They have a lot of bread products and a lot of dairy products in their diet. In the South, our climate is very conducive to fruit and to rice, and we use a lot of rice in the South. So, of course, rice is eaten all over India. Let's be honest here. And wheat is eaten all over India. It's not like they're isolated, shall we say. But with regards to the staples of their diets, in the North, you're talking about more wheat, more dairy, and more of that kind of thing. And in the South, you're talking about more seasonal vegetables that come and go with the seasons, more rice, and more sort of like a improvisational way of going about things. Because although you're going to have some constants, such as those legumes that you harvest that once a year and you keep in your storehouse all year. Aside from the rice and the legumes, the vegetables change as the seasons change.
Yeah.
In fact, I think there was a long period of time that my mother was living right next door to a farm, and she would get the cattle fodder for free from the farmer, you know, what was left over at the end of the day. And there would be like 10, 15 varieties of spinach in this, and she knew how to cook it up in such a way that, yes, it was a little bit repetitive, but it was still interesting. There was still variety going on, because that's what you're used to doing in the South, is that you make do with what you have, because you don't have that regularity of seasons. One day it'll be raining, you know, torrentially. The next day it'll be hot and dry, and you have to sort of deal with what you have.
And your summer is such that, and your winter is such that you don't have to can things in the winter. You can just keep on picking things all year round?
All year round, because it is so hot and humid the year round. I would say it's hot, you know, slightly less hot, and then rainy. Whoa.
That's really cool.
Not if you live there.
Well, it's not literally cool, but it's cool in the sense that for us, we would have to preserve everything to be able to survive in the winter without buying things flown in from places like India.
Or throw it in the snow.
Or throw it in the snow.
which, let's be clear, we have a lot of.
Yeah.
Oh, you're talking about Canada?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I was thinking about Italy, where you also have a beautiful climate all year round.
Oh, right. Well, they do have a little bit of snow, but it's not worth speaking of, really.
Swiss Alps, sorry, the Italian Alps, and that's it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.
Well, like, that's how it was in South Florida, where I grew up for a long time, is that, yes, it would be slightly less warm sometimes, but you got beautiful fresh produce the year round. As in, our farmer's market didn't have a season. They were open, you know, pretty much every day of the year.
So I've got a question that's kind of staying on my mind, because I always have avocados on my mind. Do you have avocados in India?
Not as far as I know, but I can probably bet you money that they're getting them soon.
Oh, I mean growing.
Nope.
Oh.
They don't grow natively there.
That's disappointing. I hear of these avocados that grow the size of your forearm in Mexico, and it really makes me want to emigrate from Canada.
Really, you don't, because those are the Florida avocados, which I'm very familiar with. They're extremely unpleasant.
Oh yeah?
Yeah, they're watery, and the taste is very sort of... You know how the typical Haas avocado has that slight sweetness, and it's got... that intense richness to it.
Right.
Yeah.
It's almost like, you know, spooning up pure fat and eating it that way.
Okay.
What I find with those giant avocados is that they've been forced to grow to such a size because then they become uniform in size. And so the flavor washes out completely.
Yeah, that's kind of...
What you're looking for in South America is their version of the Haas avocado, which is 10,000 times as good as the ones we've got in this country.
Cool.
Speaking of which, I've been to South America and traveled through there, and let me tell you, it's like you would go to the local cafe or eatery or whatever it is, and you would order their avocado sandwich, and this lady would have just baked some bread a couple of hours ago, just pulled it out of the oven, and it just finished cooling, so it's still slightly warm from the oven, and you order her avocado sandwich, and what she does is that she slices open the bread, you know, right through the belly and rips it open. And then she lays down some thick slabs of avocado and sprays on a bit of lemon juice, just a bit of salt. And then she lays on some really, really thick slices of tomato, throws that down, and then sprinkles on a little bit more lemon juice, a little bit of cilantro, a little bit of basil, and then drizzles on a little tiny bit of olive oil on the outside, and she presses it flat and griddles it just for a second to just get the outside slightly brown, slices it in half in a triangle, brings it out to the table, and like you can smell the tomato as the waiter is bringing it to your table. And the second you take a bite, the juices of the tomato flood your mouth, and the avocado is just like this perfect counterpoint fat, and that crispy, chewy bread is just... ideal.
Wow.
Wow.
I think we're going to have to let you go because I'm starving now.
That, my dears, is living, and that did not require any amount of expensive ingredients or omni-subs or anything else like that.
Exactly.
So because you've traveled a little bit around the world, can you speak to traveling as a vegan? Like, your options are quite open if you know how to eat out.
They're hugely open. They're hugely open wherever you go. What I've noticed is that in Europe, when you're there, pretty much everything is labeled vegan if it's vegan. Mm-hmm. I'd say by and large. If you're out in the rural areas and you just tell them you just want some vegetables, they're usually pretty obliging because chances are they're not going to have meat anyway.
Is it more popular in Europe then to be vegan?
It's more popular in Europe to be poor.
Ah, nicely put.
Like, I don't mean to be facetious about it, but it's, you know, I feel like the meat-centered diet is a very, very wealthy kind of issue where if you go out into the backwoods, into the, you know, backcountry, middle of nowhere type of places, most of the people are not eating meat every day to begin with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
By and large. And if you go to large metropolitan centers, they know vegan.
And yeah. That's what makes me sad about people liking money, because it's not like they eat meat because... they think to themselves, I hate animals. They just eat meat because they like the culture that goes around with it. Yeah, because right, they can afford it.
And so this is what happens in South America as well. If you tell them vegetarian, they usually think vegan because most of the people don't eat too terribly much dairy to begin with. So like when I told, you know, the people in Ecuador that I'm a vegetarian, they kept feeding me everything vegan because that's what they would have eaten without the meat. They would have been, you know, happy to eat a lot of beans and a lot of vegetables and the fruit. And like that sandwich I described to you. When I'm in Asia, Asia is where you have the problem, is where there is a dairy culture already built in.
Yeah.
And a very strong dairy culture built in. In Europe and Italy and France and places like that, if you're getting dairy, they're going to make sure that you know about it.
Cool.
You know what I mean? Like, they're going to put the cheese right in front of you and be like, look at this expensive cheese. It's not going to be like in India where they put, you know, in the north of India anywhere, where they put butter into everything, you know, where they put dairy into everything and sneak it into the breads and sneak it into all kinds of things like the United States does. This is the same problem that I've heard from my friends who live in Japan, where they say that when they're going to the store and stuff like that, they have to read every single ingredient because it seems like everything they buy off the shelves that's not fresh produce, and I'm not talking about fresh produce, I'm talking about packaged goods, everything has dairy in it, which is why as long as you ask for vegetables, you'll be okay. If all else fails, just ask the chef to sauté some vegetables in some oil, throw on some salt and pepper, and send it out.
Yeah. Have you ever told a chef what to do?
I've had to do it before because sometimes they're clueless, and I'm like, listen, you don't seem to be the waitress. I don't think that you seem to understand what I'm saying. Just ask them to get some oil, throw some vegetables in there, saute for about 5-10 minutes or so till it's tender, and then just send it out on top of pasta. I will be a happy man, and it works.
Wonderful.
As long as you're specific to say saute it in oil and not steam them. Yeah. Like, if it comes to the table steamed, send it back and be like, yeah, can we put some oil on there, thanks? Yeah, that'll be great. Throw it in the microwave with the oil if you have to, like I'm a 5-year-old.
Yeah, actually, when I travel around now, I bring some Indian pickled tomatoes with me, so if anything's bad, I can just pour them on.
Like my mother.
It's great.
Pours it on everything.
Yeah, it's great fixer for everything.
And that's the thing, is that I feel like everybody should have access to some kind of fixer like that. If it's not Indian pickles, then it needs to be something where, like, maybe it's sriracha, maybe it's your favorite salad dressing, maybe it's even just hummus in a little container. And I mean, how great would it be to whip out a container of hummus when someone gives you those, you know, boring salads and they don't have any dressing for you except for oil and vinegar?
Yeah, any sentence with the word hummus in it is a good sentence. Seriously, I don't care if it's like, man, this guy's going to kill me, but all I get to have is hummus. That's a good sentence.
That's a good sentence. That's a good sentence to end on, shall we say. And speaking of ending on, we're reaching the end of our time.
Yeah, we're going to have, we weren't going to continue and do the rest of our normal episode. We're just going to have a Dino exclusive for this part. Do you have anything else that you'd like to talk about? Because we're kind of out of questions.
Really?
Well, not that we don't have interest into your life, but...
keep going. That's fine. I don't mind. Because people can hear me ramble at my side, you know.
Well, maybe I could say here that on the Vegan Freak forums, Dino is known for his stories. And the first time that I saw Dino sign on, like 10 people started talking and said, Dino, story, story, story. I want to hear Dino's story. And then I unknowingly interrupted one of his stories because I didn't know who Dino was then. And people started PMing me, like private messaging me saying, guys, what are you doing? You're cutting off Dino. This is Dino's story.
Do you remember what the heck I was telling?
Well, yeah, that's when we were talking about cumin. Oh, you mean the story?
Yeah.
Yeah, the story, you were talking about the transit system. You said you came off the transit, and I kind of stayed out of that conversation because people were yelling at me. The forum is very accepting, but it seems that they're not when there's a Dino story around. I'm just kidding, nice all the time.
It's true, because I have so many of them, but... I think it's because it's part of my cultural heritage, I guess, and it's also part of my family's heritage, where my father's mother was a dancer and she was born deaf, and so for her, her dance was her way of expressing herself, but it didn't just stop there. Her father was an actor in the silent films, and so he had a lot of money, so he sent her to some of the best schools that money can buy. And so she was not only a dancer, she was a painter, she could sew, she could make costumes, she would make her own costumes, she could make jewelry, like she was a very, very talented artist on all fronts. So although she couldn't talk to you, she could certainly express herself, like she would just use a few words to get across her point, but her face was so expressive. And so from that, my father, every time he would tell a story, his entire face would get transformed and you would see whatever it is that character is that he was talking about. And of course, my mother being who she is, her father worked for the United Nations and he could talk to anybody, anytime, anywhere, for any reason. she got that from him. And so naturally, anytime she goes anywhere, she'll be sitting down. And she told me this one time she was at the airport with, you know, all her baggage, and she was bored out of her skull. So she randomly started talking to this woman sitting next to her while her husband, you know, purposefully continued to read his book. And she told me, you know, just as she was getting up, she looked at the page of that book and noticed that the husband hadn't changed the book, changed the page of the book once. And that's the kind of person my mother is. And so you have these two people who had me. And so I can talk to anybody about anything for any length of time and keep going. And it's not a problem.
And this is a good example.
As I launch into yet another story. But I think that through our stories, we sort of share a part of ourselves without getting too intimate, if that makes sense.
Yeah, for sure.
For me, cooking is such an intimate thing where if I cook for you, I care a lot about you, and it shows how much I care about you, not necessarily in the fact that I'm trying to feed you, but in the sense that I went to all this trouble of actually doing this for you. So even if you're not hungry, or if you can't eat it, shall we say, like say you have an allergy or something, as long as you acknowledge, you know, I really appreciate the effort, something like that, that's enough for me. Watching it get eaten is a whole nother ball game. But with sharing the recipes, and in the same way, just like in the book, sharing stories, if you recall, I think all the recipes had a story behind them, you're getting to see a little glimpse of me without my being too public.
Cool.
And I'm sure you guys have plenty of your own stories, which is why I listened to your podcast in the first place.
I was also going to say that what you were just talking about speaks to our culture and how we're kind of staying away from each other. That has a little bit to do with the internet, but it has a lot to do with, I think we're just afraid of really knowing each other. And I think that this leads into you talking about the Saturday meetups you do, which
Yes, the Saturday meetups have now changed to the Sunday meetups because that's when we got our CSA share. I try to do it once a week, mainly because it's fun. But aside from that, it also keeps me and Steve on our toes. I try to get together a group of whoever wants to come over, and I take all the vegetables in my fridge and I cook them, and then we all sit around and we eat and we sit and we chat and we tell stories and we entertain each other. My main big rules for those kinds of days are that the TV stays off, because I don't want it to be one of those things where you pop in a movie and everyone stares at the thing like an empty zombie for the entire time.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that we stay together in the sense that the internet goes off. You know, if you need to take a phone call, step outside, take the phone call. But like, maybe if Puppy wants to show someone something really fast, that's one thing. But you know, if we're all sitting here on Facebook while we're sitting in front of each other, no thanks. There's no point. You could have done that from your bedroom.
And it gets you to share stories with each other that you otherwise wouldn't.
And that's what happens, is that you start talking about these things that you normally don't get a chance to talk to other people about over the phone or over the internet or, hell, even on Skype. You know, you can talk for a long time, but nothing actually gets done, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does.
So what happens when you're in person, face-to-face, with a group of like 2-3 people or so, you start reaching down and you start pulling out those stories about what's been happening in your life, what's been happening in your thoughts and your feelings, your emotions that you've been going through that you wouldn't necessarily share in public. But now that you have a smaller, more intimate group to share it with, it's a lot easier to do, and it opens it up, especially since it's almost like a retreat, if that makes, you know, you cut off the TV, you cut off the phone, you cut off the texting and the IMing and the interneting and the Facebooking and the rest of it, and you just have each other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And a boatload of food, of course.
Of course.
and it does help that there is a lot of food, because I feel like when you share a meal with somebody, you feel connected to that person.
Yeah.
Yeah.
On sort of like a deeper level.
Well, hopefully someday Brennan and I can join you in one of your cooking endeavors.
That would be fantastic. But now why do you think that it's so important that families share meals together? It's not necessarily because of the act of the eating together. It's the act of bringing people together.
Definitely.
Exactly.
Especially without the outside distractions. I'm not pro-family, mind you. I'm not saying that we should all be all up in our family's business, but whatever family it is that you've chosen, shall we say, be it the family that you're living with, be it the family that are your close friends that come over once in a while, I think your family is what you make of it.
Yeah.
And in my case, because I'm living in the city so far away from the rest of my immediate family and my extended family, My closest family is my brother, who's down there in D.C., and that's a good 5 hours away by bus or train or whatever. So for me, my family is all those people who I call over every week.
Yeah.
And I think that as vegans, we really do need to make those connections with each other. Even though the internet is nice, go out there and try to find somebody to connect with. You and Brendan are so lucky that way.
Yeah, let's be clear for our listeners. Brendan and I aren't dating.
Not dating, no, we're friends.
Oh, boy. I think that's a good note to end on.
Absolutely.
So you want to mention your website so people can find you?
Yes, it's alternativevegan.com, and my personal blog is at altveg.blogspot.com. And you can email me at alternativevegan@gmail.com.
And because you won't say it, I'll say it. Go buy Dino's cookbook, Alternative Vegan. You can find it everywhere.
Right. Or listen to my podcast for free and get the cookbook after you decide that it's worth it.
Yeah, for sure. There's a lot of great cooking stuff that either comes from the cookbook or is supplementary to it.
That's all it is that I didn't have time to include everything I wanted into the book. And so sometimes I need to expand, and that's what I'm doing with the website.
Cool. You can find us at our new website, which we mentioned in number 3, www. Oh man, that was bad. www.greenhearts.ca. We did mad HTML work, so I hope you guys like it. Please send us feedback. You could email us at greenhearts@live.ca. All right.
Fantastic. We done good.
Yeah, so thanks a lot for being on our show, Dino. You're welcome back.
You. Glad to be on anytime. Tell me when you want me, and I'll make time.
Thanks.
Take care.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.